Okay, we'll call this meeting of the Climate Change Committee to order. We can have the roll call, please.
Yes, thank you. On the roll for the Board of Directors Climate Protection Committee meeting of November 19th, 2015, Director Avalos.
Here.
Director Barrett.
Here.
Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Joya. Director Haggerty. Director Rice.
Here.
Director Ross.
Here.
Director Zane. And Chair Pepper.
Here.
We have established a quorum.
Thank you. I will now move to public comment on non-agenda items. Do we have any comment cards?
I have not received any.
Okay, thanks. The next is approval of the minutes of September 17th. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Canepa, second by Ross. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed? Passes unanimously. We'll move on to item number four, which is a staff presentation on consumption-based greenhouse gas emissions inventory.
Good morning, Chair Pepper, members of the committee. You will recall that a number of occasions Air District staff has presented to you our greenhouse gas emission inventory. It's a very important part of our climate planning program. And the greenhouse gas inventory that we've presented to you is similar to our other emissions inventories. It's based on calculating emissions of pollutants from activity and production in the Bay Area. And we are also working on a different way of looking at greenhouse gases, a consumption-based inventory that's more of a life cycle examination of energy and carbon embedded in the goods and services that we use. And we think it'll be very helpful in our climate planning process. David Birch is a principal planner that's been managing this process, and he'll present this item.
Can you hear me well? Yeah. All right. So what I want to do is give you an overview of a consumption-based inventory, tell you a little bit about why we think it's a useful tool, something worth pursuing, give you a description of the methodology, share a little bit of some of the results and findings and some of the potential uses and policy implications from a consumption-based perspective. So I think you're all familiar with the concept of an emissions inventory. We've developed emissions inventories for criteria plants and greenhouse gases for many years now. It's one of the most fundamental tools that you use for air quality or climate planning. The thing that's different about a consumption-based inventory is whereas the emissions inventories that you're familiar with, generally they're developed from the production side. So it's a question of how much emissions are related to products that are goods and services that are produced in a given area, in this case, the Bay Area. With a consumption-based inventory, what we're doing is flipping that around, and we're looking at it from the other end of the process. So it's how much emissions are embedded in the goods and services that are consumed here in the Bay Area. And so that it doesn't matter whether the product is produced in San Francisco or LA or Chicago or Singapore, if it's consumed here in the Bay Area, then we will take responsibility for that in the consumption-based inventory. Another key point about the consumption-based approach is that it incorporates what's called a full life cycle analysis of the emissions that are embedded in each product. So we're trying to look both upstream and downstream over the full life of that product. So that's the production cycle, the in-use portion, as well as the disposal or recycling of the product at the end of its useful life. There's a number of deliverables from this effort. We're going to have inventory tables and charts that will be at the regional scale, at the county scale, at the city scale, and then we'll also have a series of maps that will show individual greenhouse gas footprints down to the U.S. Census block group. So why are we pursuing this effort in developing this tool? Well, as useful as a production-based inventory is for purposes of planning, when you're talking about greenhouse gases, it does not really tell the whole story. As you know, our modern economy is very integrated at both the national and global scale, and so a high proportion of the products that we consume are produced outside of this region. So the consumption-based inventory provides a tool that can account for and quantify the emissions that that are embedded in the products we consume from elsewhere. And we think that in combination with the production-based inventory, this, you know, these will complement each other and give us a more complete portrayal of what our real responsibility is from the standpoint of GHGs. And this type of an approach, I think, is especially relevant in areas like the Bay Area that are quite affluent, where we do have a lot of consumption. In terms of the potential uses of consumption inventory, this will be a tool that we will use to help inform the development of the regional climate protection strategy that we're currently working on, and to identify potential GHG reduction policies and measures. It should also be a useful tool for our colleagues and at cities throughout the region. We actually met with a subset of the local climate planners a month or 6 weeks ago and gave them a demonstration of this, and they were very excited about it, and they told us they would definitely look forward to using this themselves. And we think it can also be used for purposes of educating Bay Area residents about what's the composition of their own GHG footprint, and what are some of the effective things they could do if they're concerned about trying to reduce that footprint. And then, of course, we can also compare our footprint to that of other metropolitan areas in the state or around the country. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but I want to just kind of walk you through the concept a little bit more in terms of how you actually go about doing this. So this effort is a collaboration with the Energy Resources Group over at UC Berkeley, and especially a project that they have called the Cool Climate Network. These guys are among the leading practitioners in the world in looking at emissions from the consumption-based side of things. The whole approach is based on a ground-up, bottom-up approach, where you start with the individual household and scale up from there. And it's basically three simple steps. The first step is what I call follow the money. You develop an expenditure profile for each household. So if a household has an income of $100,000, how much of that is being spent on various aspects of transportation, or for the housing itself, for food, various goods and services. Once you've identified what that spending profile is, then you apply, in the second step, the appropriate emissions factor, which is that factor based on that life cycle analysis of how much emissions are embedded in a given dollar of clothing or beef or whatever, you know, consumer electronics. And then, so you multiply your expenditures times the emission factor. That tells you how much your emissions you have in each sector. And then you simply aggregate all those different sectors up to come up with your household footprint. These are the five expenditure categories that we group together to make it a little bit more manageable. There's actually hundreds of different products that are analyzed and then aggregated into these categories. So you see transportation would include the production of the individual vehicle and the maintenance of that vehicle, as well as how much emissions are created by the use of that vehicle, the fuel that is consumed when you drive it, as well as public transportation and air travel. If you look at housing, that sector includes not just the construction and maintenance of the residence, but also the residential energy use and the water and the disposal of the waste from that household. And you see there's a similar breakdown for the other major five categories here, the food and goods and services. So an example of this life cycle analysis approach for an automobile, if you look upstream, you'd be looking at what are all the emissions that are embedded in the production of the individual parts. And obviously there's going to be hundreds or if not thousands of parts that go into some products. You get all those and aggregate them together, then what are the emissions related to the assembly of the vehicle and shipping it to the dealer? That's the upstream side. On the in-use aspect, you have the fuel that's combusted to propel the vehicle when you're driving it. You also have the upstream emissions related to the production of that fuel, the refineries, whether the fuel's produced here in the Bay Area or elsewhere. That needs to be taken into account. And then, of course, the vehicle maintenance. And then downstream at the end of the life of the vehicle, any emissions that would be related to the landfill or recycling. And if things are recycled, that actually goes back in as a credit in the calculation. So this is a complex model because it's a complex world, right? But there's more than 30 factors that go into the whole model, but in reality, six of them account for about 92% of the variation in the household footprint. Those are the number of people in the household, the size of the home, the square footage, what's the density of the neighborhood, what's the carbon intensity of the electricity that's being used in the house, the household vehicle ownership rate, and household income. Household income is a very important one, so I want to just go into that one a little bit more, because your household GHG footprint is going to vary both in size and composition from household to household, and income has a big influence on both of those factors. It's especially a major influence in terms of the amount of emissions from the transportation sector, as well as from goods and services. When you're looking at lower income households, they tend to spend a higher percentage of their income on the basics of food and shelter, as you would expect. But as people's income increases, you see a shift toward higher consumption of goods and services, the discretionary items and things that are, you know, vacations and, luxury goods that are not affordable for lower income people. So let's look at a few actual examples of what this looks like in the real world. What we're seeing here then is a graph showing an average American household for the whole U.S. Taken together. And the average household footprint is just under 50 metric tons of CO2 equivalent per year. And you see the breakdown of each of the five sectors there. The blue portion of the bar represents direct emissions. So that's the combustion of fuel in a motor vehicle or natural gas to heat water and space heating in the home. But the majority of the emissions here are actually indirect in that they're from the production phase, the upstream aspect. A couple of points of interest here then. The transportation sector is the largest, as you see. It accounts for a little over 30% of the average household emission nationwide. But housing is the next largest sector, and electricity is a major component of the housing, of that housing bar. Now let's, for contrast, take a look at the average household in the state of California. This is 45.7, so it's about 4 metric tons per year less than the U.S. average, but there's some differences in the composition. If you look at transportation, the transportation emissions are about 3 metric tons higher than the national average, and that's a function of a higher amount of driving in California, as well as a significantly higher level of air travel. But offsetting that, if you look at the housing sector, it's significantly less than at the national average, and electricity in particular is significantly less. Now, if we look at the Bay Area, it's similar to the statewide average, but even a little bit lower. So now we're down to about 44 metric tons per household. Transportation is about the national average, although we have more air travel and a little less driving. But if it's interesting when you look at the housing sector, how small the electricity component is here in the Bay Area. And so that's partly a function of the fact that we have a moderate climate, so there's less need to heat and cool our homes. But a lot of it is also due to the fact that we have cleaner electricity. And so that's a great opportunity as we move toward electrifying our economy and moving, taking transportation and getting off of fossil fuels and getting into electric vehicles. That gives us a great opportunity there. The good news takeaway that I see here is that in the Bay Area, we enjoy a higher standard of living, and yet we still have a lower carbon footprint. So to me, that shows that, you can make it work. You can have a good quality of life and reduce your GHGs at the same time. Now, if you look at Western Europe and some of the other advanced economies, you'll see that they have a good quality of life and an even lower footprint than we do here. So there's still room for improvement, but I'd say we're on the right track. So there's a lot of different things we can delve into with this approach, but For one example, let's look at the transportation sector a little. As you saw, it's the largest slice of the overall emissions footprint in a given in a typical household. Some of the factors that come into play there are where's the home located, how many people are in the home, what's the household income, and what type of access to transit do they have. All those things then influence the vehicle ownership rate, which is really important, the trip length, average trip length, what mode choice people make when they do travel, and how much discretionary travel they choose to make. We know that we need to both reduce vehicle emissions and vehicle travel as well as decarbonize the transportation sector. One of the findings of this analysis, though, is that while it's necessary if you want to reduce amount of motor vehicle travel to have increased density, that's not enough in and of itself. If you have density somewhere out in an area that's not served by transit and there's no shopping or services nearby, people are still going to have to drive. So you want to try to combine density with the transit service and the appropriate shopping and services nearby. As I mentioned earlier, the methodology looks at not just how much people are driving, but also the emissions that are embedded in the production of the fuel. And so, you know, we're all really concerned about how we can bring down emissions from the oil refineries in the Bay Area. And, you know, you can go at that from the production end of things through regulations, but another key element of it is what can we do to reduce the demand for the fuel, because that's going to reduce emissions in the final analysis as well. Air travel is another major component of the transportation sector. That's a tough one to get at from a regulatory standpoint, but it is worth bearing in mind that air travel increases significantly as income goes up. This is a map showing the greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector by Bay Area Block Group. This is showing you that we really are doing this at a fine-grained scale. These block groups, there's over 4,700 of them in the Bay Area. There's about 500 or 600 households in a typical block group. And you can see that there's the green areas here are the ones with the lower emissions from transportation, and the red is the higher emissions. And as you would expect, and what you see in any urban area or metro area in the U.S., the urban core areas tend to have lower emissions from transportation and lower emissions overall. And as you get into the more suburban areas, people tend to need to drive more and oftentimes have larger households, et cetera. And so the footprint tends to be larger. And you know, if you look at the Alameda, Contra Costa County areas in the East Bay here, it's interesting to see how much there's a line there that kind of west of the hills versus east of the hills. But you get out into Contra Costa and there's still some pockets in places like Walnut Creek and Livermore and all in the downtown areas, the household emissions are significantly lower than in the outlying areas. So a few more points about the Bay Area GHG footprint then. If you analyze things from the consumption perspective rather than the production side of things, the inventory is about 35% larger overall because we are a wealthy area that consumes a lot. GHG footprint lower in the urban core areas, I said. Core areas tend to have smaller homes, lower vehicle ownership rate, better transit service. There's significant variation among those census block groups. The difference between the highest footprint to the lowest one is a ratio of about 7 to 1. When you look at things at the city scale, the ratio of highest to lowest is about 3 to 1 here in the Bay Area. When you aggregate up to the county level, those differences among census blocks and cities tend to kind of even out more. And so there is some variation, but they're all the countywide averages are all in the range, pretty much in the 40 metric tons to 50 metric ton range. Here's a graph showing a breakdown of the cities in Alameda and Contra Costa County. So it's showing you the breakdown among those five key sectors, transportation, housing, et cetera. And then you see the cities arrayed from Alameda on the left and Contra Costa on the right. And as you can see, there is a considerable amount of variation among the cities, And normally, for the most part, it's those cities west of the hills that have a lower emissions, as we saw in the previous slide. So in terms of a few key takeaway points, consumption-based inventory is a tool to complement our existing production-based inventory and help us get a more complete picture of our true impact as a region on global warming. The inventory, if you look at it from a consumption perspective, is larger than the existing traditional production-based inventory. We think this is a tool that can be used to inform climate planning at the regional and local scale and to identify the most promising opportunities for GHG reductions. As I was showing you, there is considerable variation at the neighborhood level, and so that's information that could be useful for tailoring messages and education to develop appropriate strategies to help people reduce their footprint. Some of this information may be useful to inform our regulatory efforts. A lot of it, though, when you're talking about the consumption side, may lend itself more to the public education side of things. So this is a new tool for us. It's only recently that we've gotten this information. We're still digesting it. We're talking to people. We're talking to local planners to help us extract as much useful ideas from this as possible. But we think it's an interesting direction. It's worth going. We're going to be making these maps and graphs and charts and all available to local planners and to the public to help get that word out, because it should be good information. So with that, I'll close and be happy to share any further detail. We have maps loaded and all, if you did want to take a look at that.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we've got some questions up here, and then we have one public comment. Oh, Mr. Director Haggerty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little perplexed about something you said, so I guess it didn't take me long to get perplexed. The largest factor of GHG is what? I know the answer, but I just want to hear you say.
The largest factor, there's six factors that are shown.
The largest is motor vehicles, correct?
Well, transportation sector is the largest sector. That's correct.
So I was a little perplexed on slide 15 when you said the reason that there's higher GHG emissions outside of the urban core in the suburbs is because that we drive more. I've always been told by this air district for the 19 years I've been sitting on this dais is the reason that I choke and smog and everything else in the afternoon is because what happens in the 880 corridor in the morning.
If we're talking about ozone, that's the true statement. Here I'm only looking at greenhouse gas emissions.
So the greenhouse gases don't migrate too?
Greenhouse gases are global in scale. And
I know,
so
but the greenhouse gases that are generated in, for example, let's be specific, in the 880 corridor in the morning, they just sit there all day. They don't move over to the valley like everything else.
I'm not aware that they behave in that.
I don't know. I'm asking.
I think that when we're thinking about greenhouse gases, they are a global pollutant. They go up into the atmosphere. They affect everywhere over time. They don't cause breathing difficulties downwind, as ozone does, creation of ozone. So it's a global pollutant that is of global concern because of the climate impacts. It's not about direct breathing concerns.
I'm struggling with the answer. I'm not. Okay. I believe what you're saying, but I don't.
Yeah. So in terms of the
digest it for a minute. And
yeah.
See if
come
I
back.
Agree
okay.
With what's being said. Well,
that'd be great. Yeah.
Director Haggerty came in a little bit late. I think it's about what this is measuring is per household, how much are we generating? And of course, it's on a per household basis. So it's less dense farther. We're denser in the corridor. So on a per capita basis, people who live in the 880 corridor, there's more folks. So you divide it all up, and that part of that smog or whatever the emissions you're concerned about that are coming out of the corridor are from people who are actually driving over the hill to jobs, you know, in the more urban core would be my guess. But it's a little bit about what this is trying to tell us is on a per household basis, what are we responsible for in terms of our consumption, travel, et cetera.
So I guess I hear what you say, but I just can't. The fact that urban or the suburban people drive more is not the factor then.
It is the fact. I think that as you look at this, these are not measured CO2 emissions in your area. These are what the houses in that area are generating versus what we show you in terms of ozone is what we're actually measuring at the Livermore site.
Well, then maybe we should invest more in transit in the suburban areas so people will take transit.
Absolutely.
I think one of the reasons.
Answer. That's the answer. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Director Barrett.
Thank you. One of the things on slide number 7, major expenditure categories that really is, I think, missing, but shows up in the later slides under the increased air traffic or travel, is you really don't, under housing, you're not really looking at the effect of tourism in hotels. You know, that doesn't, I don't see where that's measured anywhere. And I know that those are not people who live here, but that is part of what is consumed here.
Right.
We're actually providing it. So, you know, there is an upstream and a downstream side to all those expenses. And also the vacations that under services or what people in the, where we're traveling, that's also part of what we're spending money on that has an upside and an upstream side and a full life cycle greenhouse gas effect that's not being measured here.
So that, you make a good point, and let me try to respond to that. As I said at the outset, the way this whole concept works, the emissions for any activity or any good that's consumed are attributed to the end user or consumer. And it's a different approach than the normal inventory. Because, for instance, with transportation emissions in our traditional inventory, how many miles are being driven in the Bay Area? And so we're only responsible for, if we're driving within our boundaries, it only shows up in our inventory in that case. But if a Bay Area person drives to Seattle, those emissions are attributed.
Somebody else's
outside. Right. But in the consumption-based world, it's based on what you as a, if you're a Bay Area resident, we're going to take responsibility for all of your emissions, even if you're driving to Seattle. So when you talk about tourism and travel, the emissions from the people that are visiting us from Paris or whatever,
okay,
it's attributed to them wherever they live. Okay. Now, are the emissions, if you and I go to London or Bogota, those emissions are going to be show up in the Bay Area inventory because we live here.
Where are they on that major expenditure category? Under entertainment?
They're going to show up under air travel and then under, because entertainment has many, many subcategories within there.
And
that's where it would show up.
Yeah, no, I'm just asking because I didn't see that. I get the idea that tourism, okay, that's your, Mr. German man, that's your expense. And your greenhouse gas, but ours then to Bogota is ours, and that's going to be here. Okay, the other thing that I was a little curious about is in your key points, number 18, you're saying that some of these, one of the big effects of this might be public education, and I think this is very, very interesting, and I do think this is the way to go, because last year just at this last air and waste management conference, a big part of what isn't happening is the whole reduction in use. And, that is where it's going to make a difference. You know, we used to be reduce, reuse, and recycle. Now it's just recycle. And that's having a big, major effect on waste management because the money isn't there anymore because of the strong dollar and the bad international economy. So I think this whole idea of reduction is really important. I've seen that the Marin energy has a much better level of reduced energy consumption than the Sonoma Clean Air does. And it's something that we need to be looking at, not just providing 100% green energy, but also reducing people's use of it. And I think that this is really something, and I think that waste management really is a very reasonable partner for us in this, because they need to figure out how to make this recycling work. And if we're reducing people's use, then we're reducing the recycling load. Just an idea.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, David, for the presentation. And follow up on that, on Director Barrett's comments. Yeah, I was wondering to what end we will use this information and how that'll be conveyed, and what is our goal with the information. It's nice to find out what our greenhouse gas calorie count is per person. How are we going to translate in that to tangible and efficacious action? I also want to follow up. She's correct on the reducing, you know, the products we consume. Transportation obviously is the easiest and most obvious one, but reducing product use and packaging and everything. I've had a nascent thought about one day myself just taking a bag with me. And from the moment I wake up, everything from my K-cup to apple core, I just drag it around with me all day. I just throw it in the bag and take it around with me all day. The wrapper at lunch, anything. And for water, I would have a jug and I'd mark, okay, I flushed 3 times and, you know, blah, 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 and mark that. And at the end of the day, I'd have like a Santa Claus bag of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a very interesting component. And you could throw in the GHG component by maybe putting a balloon in there too. This is how much represents how many pounds I've used today. I think something like that would be astounding to show people how much. I mean, I'm astounded. If I add it all up, it would probably fill a kitchen trash bag easily. I'm really wasteful. I have everything. I like little packages. I like big packages. I got Starbucks cups all over my car. I've got wrappers and everything. I think if we could come up with a visual like that and to get the public engagement around how much we're using, just not just for the landfill, but all the GHGs that we're incorporating in making that, all that stuff. And I think it might be of interest. Where you live, it's hard to get people to say, okay, well, it's nice, I live in Livermore and I have to drive to my job. Well, why don't you bring my job here and then I can reduce my transit? You know, that's not going to happen. But on the individual usage, I think once we get this information, we got to figure out a way to convey it so that it's salient and perhaps has an actual result.
No, you make an excellent point, and we're still kind of digesting this and thinking about how we're going to use the information. I mean, I think the basic premise is that knowledge is powerful if you can apply it, right? And we know that there's a lot of people in the Bay Area that are concerned about global warming and would like to do things to try to reduce their footprint, but they don't necessarily have a great understanding of which of the things, you know, which actions and which products and all are the ones that are contributing the most to their emissions. And so this is a tool that can be used at the household level to help inform them. And there's some interesting, you know, takeaways to me, like going into this project, I didn't really know, let's say, how much food accounts for the overall footprint in an average household. And I was surprised to see that in the Bay Area, because we have pretty low housing emissions. I was showing you that graph. Sean, can you bring up the one for the San Francisco Bay Area, that bar graph? So, you know, our housing emissions are actually only about half the national average. But food, on a relative basis, is a bigger one for the Bay Area than housing. That was a surprise to me. So, you know, obviously we're not going to, you know, develop a rule that says you have to eat less, but we can look at what are some of the things that people can do that would be effective in reducing the emissions from the food sector. You know, you can, for instance, meat and dairy products on a unit basis are higher emitters of GHGs than fruits and vegetables, let's say. So nutritionists have been trying to, you know, convey that message that you need to eat more fruits and vegetables for for many, you know, many years. But, you know, we can potentially add another perspective to that and say it's also true from the standpoint of global warming. So there's, you know, there's health benefits, but there's also environmental benefits if you move in that direction. You know, we're not going to try to dictate what people eat, but you can make information available, and some people will respond to that.
And just a follow-up thought on that, David. I know that I thought that in England and maybe in some places in the U.S., they had a GHG calorie count printed on some of the labels. One of the supermarket chains did that. And I read that it wasn't really taking hold. Can we find out about how that effort really worked? So every product would have, you know, this results in that. And I know that that effort has been done elsewhere.
Yeah, that's something we should definitely look into, and that's a good suggestion.
I heard it wasn't taking on very well, but it's been done. Maybe that's something we ought to consider. Thank you.
On that same slide, what is other food? Is that restaurant eating out, or is that just like packaged non-GMO stuff?
A lot of it is going to be.
I mean, dairy. I mean, what else? What are the? I mean, well, what alcohol? I mean, is that alcohol and beer and?
Yeah.
What is it?
Alcohol and beer are considered alcohol. Food. There's not a separate item for them here. But there's also like a lot of things that are sort of like snacky type foods that don't necessarily like a donut. You know, is that a yeah? Is that a cereal or is that?
I'm sure it is.
So as you see, that's a pretty big slice of the overall food, and there are so many processed food products that I think a lot of them end up going into that portion.
So thank you. This is, I think, really interesting. I have a couple questions. One, how does the concept of a consumption-based inventory differ from what we, when we talk about carbon footprint, for those of us who think about that sort of thing?
I think they're very much related.
When we have talked about carbon footprint in the past, it's about what is everything that goes into that product you're consuming, or what is our carbon footprint as a human being, or whether. So it's pretty much the same. The concept is the same: carbon footprint and consumption-based inventory.
Yeah, a consumption-based inventory is a tool that can be used to help you.
I just want to get
quantify your
yeah.
your.
So we've used the term carbon footprint has been used for a while now. So,
right.
But I just want to make sure it's sort of similar. So my other question.
If I could just say that I've been using the term GHG footprint here, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
The reason I use GHG is because for some types of products, it's not just carbon. There's methane and other types of greenhouse gases that are included. So I think GHG is, in a sense, a little bit more accurate of a term, but it's the exact same idea.
Okay. And then I agree with my colleagues. I think the biggest benefit of doing this is going to be around education and awareness, because this is all about people understanding their carbon footprints. And making choices to, you know, if they choose to reduce them. So one of the questions I have around that is, like, for instance, when we're looking at the food sector, when you're measuring the carbon footprint of that box of Cheerios or those Cheerios you're eating, is it taking into account the carbon footprint associated with the packaging?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So therefore, I'm guessing Cheerios that you buy bulk out of the bulk bin have a much lower carbon footprint, or should I would some measure less smaller carbon footprint than Cheerios that you buy, you know, packaged in the box from Kellogg's or whoever they make them.
Right. Absolutely. And I think one of the takeaways, if we wanted to pursue the food side of things for purposes of public education, is, you know, you don't necessarily need to eat less food, but eat less processed food, you know.
Yeah, no, it's the packaging. Right, we were talking about this packaging piece. It's really, and then I was thinking the same thing around, we have the calorie count, nutritional value label, you know, how about that carbon footprint label? And then the other thing that I know we is done in some markets is around produce. They'll not only identify what the produce is, but also where it came from, and then specifically how many miles this produce traveled to get to the store. So you're buying your grapes from Chile, you know, I'm assuming a much bigger carbon footprint than grapes that were grown up in, you know, Sonoma, what have you. So So I think this is all really good about getting down, giving people information about how their consumption behavior has an impact on, you know, there's a big cost to buying something with a lot of packaging versus buying something with less packaging. So I really...
And the other piece of that is there's... It's not just packaging, but there's energy used in food processing. It's and so, you know, again, if you eat the more, you know, natural product, the one that's been processed less, you're gonna reduce emissions.
So one more question on the food piece: does that account for so California and even in the Bay Area, a lot of our agricultural industry? Would that also take into account the greenhouse gas emissions associated with pesticides, herbicides, the chemicals used in agriculture?
Yes. In fact, I've done a little research into the food thing because I got interested in it when I found this number. I was like, wow, that's more, you know.
You're looking really thin, too. So.
I will accept donations of food. But actually, if you look at the GHGs from the food sector, it's interesting because CO2 is only about 44%, and about 32% of it's coming from nitrous oxide or N2O, and that is directly related to the fertilizers that go into the production. And then there's also the remaining 20-some percent is methane, and that's related to primarily to dairy and meat production with the what they call the enteric fermentation in dairy and other cattle.
Okay. Did you have something?
No, your turn.
Okay, thank you. So this appears to me that this wasn't a good presentation for me to show up late to, but I'm struggling. And my colleague to the left of me said this isn't that difficult, but maybe I'm just having a difficult day. If I look over on slide 17 and I look at, say, Pleasanton, and is that just the carbon footprint for those residents, or is that including people that are traveling through that community?
It's strictly based on the people that live in that community, the people that reside there.
Okay, so to what extent are we sharing this data with our colleagues at MTC? Because if, as I was admonished, that is the question, or that is the answer about transit in the suburbs, that's not what they're saying. And so I'm wondering, you know, as somebody who sits on other regional boards in the area, and I go to one regional board and they're saying we should be doing more transit in the suburbs, and then I go over to MTC or Plan Bay Area, for example, and we need to abandon the suburbs and we need to put all the transit in the three urban cores, to what extent do we share this data with them?
I think it's our intention to share it with them. We've actually only had this information for a few weeks now, and we didn't want to start sharing it with the whole world before we shared it with you folks, but it would be our intention to make this data available and talk with them. We think it's, you know, it'll be useful for their efforts and potentially can help inform Plan Bay Area as well.
And that's kind of where I was going to go and I was going to lead to, because I think it is important that, you know, we're in the midst of Plan Bay Area right now, and we've voted on the goals yesterday, and none of this data was available to us as we were talking about goals and you know, what we wanted to see come out of Plan Bay Area, and it would have been helpful to have this. So I think that you need to share this with MTC and ABAG as soon as possible, but I would also like for you to share it with BARC, and I know Allison's here, but I think that this presentation should be brought to us. Do you agree with that, Allison? Did you say yes, I do, Mr. Chair? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would like to see this presentation over at BARC, because I think that would be all four of the agencies sitting there hearing the information. And I'm going to tell you, one of the reasons I'm still a little confused is because this is kind of a departure from where we've been going. I mean, I'm not saying all of a sudden, you know, this is the game changer, but this is a different discussion. This is a different level of discussion, and that's why I was confused, because it's not what we're being told at other regional agencies.
If I may, this is absolutely new information for us, which we're sharing with you. We thought it was important to share with you, and we will share with others. And it is a new way of looking at greenhouse gases and how we look at the emissions of greenhouse gases. It's a new way of looking at that. It will be instructive for all of us, and we welcome a lot of discussion about how this information will be useful to us as we work to reduce our greenhouse gases. And so we will certainly share it with the other regional agencies and talk with Allison about getting it on the BARC agenda.
Madam Chair, could I make?
I would also think that it would be really helpful to get this in front of the planning committee, the joint planning committee of ABAG and MTC as soon as possible, because we're making decisions that, you know, are going to be for the next 4 years. It would be helpful to get some of this new forward thinking involved.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Birch. I just have several questions. The first one is, I think what you're doing is wonderful. Are there other areas throughout the U.S. or throughout the world that have done similar studies, and where have they been conducted?
Yes, we are not the first, even though we like to be in the vanguard. Here's a slide right here that shows it's not necessarily a complete list, but these are some of the jurisdictions that have done consumption-based inventories within the last 6 or 7 years. City and County of San Francisco actually did one. That's not to say that all these studies are exactly the same. The methodologies can differ some. I think one thing that makes our study a little bit more advanced or unique is that, for instance, the one that was done for the state of Oregon, that was just a statewide inventory. They don't have anywhere near the kind of fine geographic breakdown that we did with this one. So to the extent that fine geographic information is useful, that's a feature that we have that most of these other ones don't.
Got it. The other thing I was going to ask you, in terms of, I think it's great, because I tend to focus on more on production-based. And it's good that you're focusing on the consumption-based. In terms of best practices, what have you learned from these other cities and other jurisdictions? And what, in terms of, what have you incorporated? Or are you totally, in terms of the methodology, are you going in a different direction? I mean, are you taking bits and pieces? What are you doing exactly?
So in terms of best practices, it's a relatively small field at this point in terms of the number of practitioners. There's some consultants that used to be with something called Stockholm Energy Research, and then they moved to a different consulting company. They did probably about three of these inventories here. But the folks we worked with at UC Berkeley, who developed the Cool Climate Network, they're really the other leading practitioners in the field. The ICLEI program has developed a protocol for how to do a consumption-based inventory, which our inventory follows that protocol. But regardless of who's doing the inventory and exactly which method they use, they all follow the same template of using this life cycle analysis, looking upstream and downstream, and using an economic model that will develop that follow the money idea, where you figure out how people are spending their money and then what emissions are embedded in that. And then you can go different directions with that, but those are kind of the core principles that underlie all of these efforts.
I just wanted to echo what my colleagues have said. I think for the end user, which is me and you, I think it's empowering to know that sort of information in terms of what we are consuming. And so I would just encourage you to continue on with the good work and to work with your colleagues in the field. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to tag on to Director Haggerty's comment about, yes, this is a different direction, and it's true. It's an astute observation, because we have, except in the spirit of the air, try to get people out of their cars and take public transit. We have been looking at the sources of the industrial sources, the refineries, looking at source production of GHGs. When we start to look at the consumer and the demand side, the reason it's not brought up at a lot of agencies or by activists, I think, is because nobody wants to tell the consumer, this is your fault. If we want people to eat less ice cream, then we should tell them, Well, or if they want people to stop making so much ice cream, we'll stop buying it. And if we want people to reduce, you know, the emissions from refineries, we'll stop buying that product. And I think the Bay Area is a food-oriented place, and we pride ourselves on that. And we can look to the food industry as how they've educated, how things have come up over the decades in the food world, starting with MSG. Oh, this food has MSG in it. Then it was trans fats, and then now it's gluten, and all of a sudden this huge awareness of what's in my food, and the food industry, for some reason, we're very tuned to that now. We can, if it's in the food, God, we know about it. Red dye number two. The list is endless. About every 2 years, some salt. Every 2 years, something piques our interest. Oh my God, this is in my food. It's going to kill me. Well, nobody's looking at the GHG aspect of it. I think we can take a cue from the food world and take that bold step to go to the demand side to actually tell the public, this stuff wouldn't be here if you didn't buy it. Or if you do buy it, here's what else you're buying along with it. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I guess based on all the other comments, building on the other comments that people have said, by using a consumption-based inventory, though, what would that look like for a person in China? So that would show very possibly very low GHG footprint. But one of the things we want to see happen in China is to not have, you know, coal being burned there to produce all the products that we consume here. So I guess I'm just noting that it might kind of end up leading to actions that maybe are not, I don't know. I think we need to put both of them together.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And one of the things you said, the potential use of this is to compare our Bay Area GHG footprint to other areas. And thank you for the questions. Where else has this been used? If it hasn't been used in a lot of other areas, then, you know, should we be encouraging those places to use them? Or I guess I'm worried about the kind of apples to oranges comparison. And one of the things that we wanted to see happen with this climate effort at the district here is to make sure we're all using the same methodologies, and that all of these climate action plans that all the different cities and counties are putting together are using the same methodology. This is a different methodology. Do we want everyone to use this? Do we want everyone to use both? I guess I'm wondering where we go with this.
Well, I think if I could jump in. Or,
yes, please.
I mean, we're not suggesting by any means that this should replace the production-based inventory. There's room for both, and there's a need for both, and so they should complement each other. When we met with that subset of planners from local cities a month or so ago, one of the things we heard from them was, you know, not only this is useful information, but, you know, this is great if you guys can provide an inventory for our cities, and it's being done on using a consistent methodology throughout the region, then, you know, that's terrific for us, because, you know, you're giving us information and we know it's being done on a consistent basis. So I don't think there needs to be a big concern about, you know, differences in methodology within the region, at least as long as we're doing it at the regional scale and giving them a local breakdown. Your comment about China is interesting very much. You know, obviously, if you look at the goals for 2030 and 2050 and the amount that we need to reduce emissions, you know, it applies on both the production and the consumption side, right? And so, you know, right now we're at roughly 45 metric tons per household per year. By year 2050, we would need to be down at something like, you know, 6 or 7 tons per household per year. So how do we do that and still maintain the standard of living that we're accustomed to? Obviously is one of the, you know, the interesting challenges. China, I don't know the exact number for what an average household footprint is, but it probably is more in the range of 5 to 8 tons per year if I had to pick a number out of the air. All those coal emissions are a big concern, and obviously everybody's, you know, trying to get off of coal, and the Chinese have, you know, at least are saying that they're going to move in that direction. But one of the things about a consumption-based inventory is that it you know, a lot of those emissions that are being generated in China are for the production of goods and services that are consumed here in the U.S. and other advanced economies. And so, you know, even though we're not telling them to burn coal, to the extent that we're using the products they're producing, you know, we're a bit implicated in that coal consumption, right?
Right. Okay, we have one public comment, too. Yes, go ahead.
So just to tag on to that, one of the things, so that product that's coming from China, perhaps, same product that maybe can be produced here as well in the United States, has a much, that the China product may have a much higher carbon footprint, but it may have a lower price point in the marketplace. And that's one of the tensions here as well, because that price point in the marketplace doesn't reflect the ongoing carbon cost. So that's the really abstract thing that's hard to communicate. But it will end up costing us more to lower, potentially for us here, to lower our carbon footprints than other places. Anyway, just a comment.
Yeah, actually, it would be interesting to compare the production of the same item here versus in China, just from a carbon cost. And part of the problem is there is no price that's put on carbon. So if that price was put on carbon and included in the price of the product, then maybe it would change and the production would come back here. Or who knows what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll go. Let's go. Thank you very much. We have one public comment, Jed Holtzman.
Hello, Chair Pepper and directors. Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area, your local, friendly, regional climate advocacy nonprofit. I want to thank Mr. Birch and his staff. I think this is a really interesting conversation. The city, I live in San Francisco, and the Department of Environment did this some years ago. But I think that in terms of the applicability of the study, yours is obviously much higher because you have so many jurisdictions. I do think consumption is more appropriate than production, because we could kind of wall ourselves off here and, you know, say we ban industry but then keep consuming things and then we have a clean footprint, but that's not really true. At the same time, consumption is more modeled than measured, and as you pointed out, we can't control, while we may consume things that are made in China, we don't politically control the policy choices there on what they're using to manufacture those. So it kind of holds us accountable for some consumption choices where we can't necessarily do anything but stop buying that. I want to point out that food, goods, electricity, construction, basically almost everything on this boils down to fossil fuels, even the non-transportation section, because we're talking about fossil fuels of manufacturing, processing, and shipping, all of these things. So it just really highlights the critical importance of strong regulatory strategies here, which, as we've been saying for years, the goal is not just to have them here, but to export them from here, which we will play a strong role in once we get them done. I want to back up Director Haggerty. It's critical that we share this as widely as possible, because when you look at that, the one graph that with the color map, the regional transportation planning, you know, where are regional emissions too high? Where do we need to, you know, drive transit dollars? I think this, you know, this is a great way to look at that. Another important thing to look at, slide 9, six factors account for 92% of the variation in the GHG footprint. And if you look at those, you know, not a lot of those things can really be changed. So it's critical, like, you're not going to, you know, buy a different house or change the population density of your neighborhood. Those are kind of baked in. So it really is critical to do what you can across, you know, all the types of your authority to reduce the carbon intensity of electricity and vehicle ownership rate, which are two of these six critical characteristics. Also important to note that, you know, you play basically the primary role in reducing carbon intensity of the upstream refining in your jurisdiction, which is a big chunk in the transportation sector, and also a chunk in other people's consumption-based inventories all over where our fuels are going. So again, just highlighting the really strong need for strong climate regulation, strong refinery regulation, and you will have an opportunity to provide strong refinery regulation next month. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other comments or discussion about this item? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. It was a very enlightening discussion. I will now move on to item number 5, which is the presentation on the short-lived climate pollutant strategy.
Good morning, Chair Pepper, members of the committee. Recall that the state's scoping plan and the Air District's regional climate protection strategy are both organized around 9 economic sectors. One of the categories of emissions that both the state scoping plan and our climate strategy are including are the short-lived climate pollutants. State legislation requires ARB, the Air Resources Board, to prepare a separate plan for short-lived climate pollutants. A draft has been released, and Abby Young, our climate manager, will present this item.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pepper and committee members. Yes, so I am presenting, giving a brief overview of a very important document that ARB has released. It's a draft strategy for reducing short-lived climate pollutants. And as Henry mentioned, in 2014, there was some legislation, SB 605, that directed ARB to develop a statewide strategy to reduce short-lived climate pollutants by the end of 2015. So that's what we're talking about today, is that draft strategy. Significantly reducing these pollutants statewide was one of Governor Brown's 5 pillars that he announced in his inaugural address last January as a key element of the state's approach to meeting the long-term greenhouse gas reduction strategy of reducing 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. So this is a key piece of that strategy. And this is very good timing for us because, as you know, we're in the midst of developing our 2016 Clean Air Plan and Regional Climate Protection Strategy, and there will be a section on short-lived climate pollutants as well as a robust control strategy in that document. We've been collaborating with ARB staff on developing concepts and potential measures for that, that plan, and so this is excellent timing, and we anticipate that our strategy and ARB's strategy will be very complementary and mutually supportive. So what are we talking about? What are short-lived climate pollutants? They are pollutants that share 2 main characteristics. They are short-lived, which means they remain in the atmosphere a much shorter time than other climate pollutants like carbon dioxide. And then the other characteristic is that they have a very high ability to trap heat. We also call this a global warming potential. So they are short-lived, and they are very effective at contributing to global warming. And the pollutants that ARB is focusing on in its strategy are methane, black carbon, which is the result of incomplete combustion of fossil fuels or wood, and fluorinated gases. So fluorinated gases they don't exist in nature. They're human-made, and many of these gases were, the ones we're talking about in this strategy, were introduced as substitutes for ozone-depleting substances, CFCs and HCFCs, as a result of the Montreal Protocol. So replacing those ozone-depleting gases with HFCs was very important in order to stabilize and restore the stratospheric ozone layer, but it really didn't do a lot on the issue of global warming. So it merely substituted a new class of climate-forcing pollutants for another. So this is one of the fastest growing class of greenhouse gases in the state, as well as the nation, as well as the Bay Area. So very important to look at these as well. So in ARB's strategy, there's a good discussion of what the potential for stemming global warming and climate change could be if we were to act very aggressively on these short-lived climate pollutants. And they mention a number of studies that indicate that if currently available technologies were universally adopted, you know, internationally, we would see a cut in global warming in the rise in global warming by about 50% by 2050. We would see about a two-thirds reduction in warming in the Arctic, where warming is more intense than in other parts of the globe. We would see a significant slowing in sea level rise, and we could potentially increase our chances of staying below that critical 2 degrees Celsius increase by about 90%. And it's because of both those characteristics, the short-lived nature and the high ability to trap heat, that we can see that immediate impact on climate change by taking action, when we take action to reduce them. So what this is a table directly from ARB's report, and this kind of shows you what we're talking about with this lifespan and this high global warming potential. So first, let's talk about lifetime. Carbon dioxide roughly has a lifetime in the atmosphere of about 100 years. So after 100 years, its ability to absorb energy and trap, or same as trapping heat, ends or rapidly declines. For methane, by contrast, its lifetime in the atmosphere is about 12 years. So after 12 years, it is no longer an effective climate warming agent. Fluorinated gases, we're talking about a range of gases here, a number of different gases, so we've got a range of years from about 1.4 up to 52 years, but still very much on the shorter end when compared to CO2. And then black carbon exists in the atmosphere as a heat trapper for only a few days to a few weeks, so very, very short lifetimes. So now, if we look at what this heat-trapping ability or global warming potential, that's what GWP stands for, if we look at this, there are a couple of different ways to look at it. The global warming potential of carbon dioxide is always kind of used as the reference point. So when we talk about the global warming potential of carbon dioxide, it's always one. And then other greenhouse gases are put in terms of carbon dioxide. So if we look over to the 100-year time frame, the right-hand column, the 100-year time frame is the most commonly used planning horizon over which the relative impact of a greenhouse gas is assessed. So most frequently in literature and plans, you see this 100-year time, and inventories, you see this 100-year time frame. But for the purposes of determining the impact of different policy choices, it's helpful, and the IPCC even suggests it may be better, to look at a shorter time frame when we talk about gases that have shorter lifetimes. So to sort of illustrate this point, if we're looking at methane, it's global warming ability, its ability to trap heat, is stretched and averaged over 100 years when it really ends after 12. So using a 100-year time frame tends to dilute the potency of methane, and it gives us a bit of a false picture of what methane's contribution is to influencing global warming. If we look at a shorter time frame, a 20-year time frame, we get a more realistic picture of how methane affects the global climate today. We see a less diluted picture. And so that's why ARB has provided two different timescales here, so that you can see over the more commonly used 100-year time frame what the global warming potential of methane is and fluorinated gases and black carbon. But if we use a shorter, more realistic time frame, the global warming potential of these gases is much, much higher. So what I'm trying to illustrate with this is that reducing short-lived climate pollutants is really the most potent tool that we have in our arsenal today to having an immediate impact on climate change. So it's incredibly important. But I also want to make the point that this is not a substitute for aggressively addressing carbon dioxide. We absolutely have to do that as well. But we need to do these two things in tandem. So what do these two timeframes look like if we're talking about the Bay Area's greenhouse gas portfolio? And what we have here are two pie charts showing the dominant greenhouse gases in the Bay Area. The gray is carbon dioxide. The yellow is nitrous oxide. The blue are these high HFC-type fluorinated gases, and the orange is methane. Black carbon you don't see here, and this is because while we do have a regional inventory for black carbon, we haven't integrated black carbon into our full greenhouse gas inventory. So that effort is still underway, but we can't, we don't have an inventory that includes it with all these other greenhouse gases. But what you can see is that if we switch from a 100-year time frame to a 20-year time frame, the share of the regional emissions that these short-lived climate pollutants comprises increases significantly, and you can see how much more important they become. So very quickly, I just wanted to go over the sources of these emissions in the Bay Area. So the top left pie chart is methane. The top right pie chart are those high global warming potential HFC emissions. And the lower pie chart is black carbon. So what you can see with methane, our largest source is recycling and waste. The vast majority of that is methane from landfills. There's also a little bit from composting facilities and wastewater treatment. The next largest is agriculture, and we're really talking about animal manure in that pie chart. That's the dominant piece. And then in the purple slice, the industrial sources are primarily fugitive emissions and leaks of methane from the natural gas distribution and oil and gas wells. And then if we look down to black carbon, we can see that transportation is a very large component here. That's largely the diesel emissions from both on-road and off-road vehicles. We also see a large amount from industry, and that's, again, this incomplete combustion of fossil fuels that we see at our heavy industry. And the residential and commercial portions, that's where we see the wood smoke. So a lot of that, especially in residential, is wood smoke. In commercial, we do also see some diesel from backup generators, as well as some emissions from black carbon emissions from commercial cooking. And then up in the HFCs, that huge chunk there is refrigeration and air conditioning, particularly in large commercial units, is by far the dominant. Those are the dominant sources for HFCs. What we don't see represented here are the black carbon emissions from wildfires. And this is something that we're having some conversations with some researchers at UC Berkeley and elsewhere in the state to try to get more of a handle on what is the potential increase in wildfire emissions in California due to climate change, how might those affect the Bay Area, and then what might we as an air agency be able to contribute to trying to stem that increase. So that's a piece that you don't see here, but it's likely very important. So there are a lot of things that ARB and the Air District have done to date to address these different emissions, and I'm not going to read through this, but just a few, pull out a few. California has the most stringent methane limits on landfills in the entire country, and in the Bay Area, on top of that, we also add our own regulations to landfills as well. We're currently engaged, Air District staff is engaged in rulemaking efforts with ARB and the CPUC on reducing methane from the natural gas distribution system and oil and gas wells. Black carbon has been reduced from human-caused sources, so that's the difference, human-caused versus wildfires, by about 90% since 1960, and a large part of that are the state and regional rules on and incentives on vehicle motors and fuels. And so that's had a very big impact in California on black carbon emissions. And then, of course, the Air District has probably, I believe, the most robust residential wood smoke program, at least in the state. Fluorinated gases, the Air District has been collaborating with ARB on enforcing some of ARB's rules, particularly on semiconductor manufacturing and also on some refrigerants. So quite a lot that we've been working on already. So back to ARB's strategy, and these are the targets that they're working with within the strategy. And one thing to note is in the bottom line, the increase that's forecast for fluorinated gases between the base year of 2013 and the forecast year of 2030. And this does assume that all currently adopted regulations and rules continue to have an effect through 2030. We see over a 50% increase. And as I mentioned before, these fluorinated gases are the fastest growing greenhouse gases in the state. So that's very critical. And then you can see the targets in both tons and percent reductions. So it's a very, very aggressive set of targets and strategy. So in developing the reduction strategy, ARB is looking at some common driving principles for each of these pollutant areas. They want to see diverse benefits, or sometimes we call them co-benefits, particularly in reducing particulate matter and other air pollutants, achieving financial savings, things like this. Addressing organic waste and trying to get it out of the waste stream by putting it to beneficial use is something that crosses a lot of economic sectors, from using it for compost amendment in agriculture to utilizing it for bioenergy and biofuels. So that's a very big piece of this that we see crossing sectors throughout the strategy. And then they want to focus on practical solutions. And in some cases, they speak directly about working with air districts on things like facility siting and permitting, working with businesses on access and testing of technologies, things like this. Investing in emission reductions in communities. And here they're really talking about trying to invest in communities that are particularly impacted by particulate matter and other air pollutants. So this is a recurring theme throughout this strategy, is really trying to focus implementation, at least in part, on the communities that need it most. And then lastly, advancing the science of short-lived climate pollutant sources and emissions. And this really gets at trying to improve our monitoring and measuring of these pollutants and our knowledge about what sources actually contribute. And this is an area where the Air District is working very closely with ARB. As I know that you're aware, we have a fixed site methane monitoring system in place now, and we are actually getting readings, and staff is planning to present on some findings at the American Geophysical Union National Conference in December. So this is an area where we're particularly right now contributing to this effort. So I'm not going to talk about this next slide in detail, but my next three slides look at each of these emissions and kind of visually show what ARB is proposing. And this strategy right now has a lot of broad proposals in it, with many of the more complex layered details to be developed as the strategy is implemented. So let me just take a couple examples. In dairy manure, this is a big reduction that they're aiming for methane. In addition to potential new regulations and $500 million over 5 years, now that's not all from state agencies, but that would be, you know, grants, incentives, loans, leveraging private investment. But that's what they think it's going to take to achieve the level of methane capture at dairies that we need to achieve. But there's also developing markets for soil amendment, getting pipeline injection of biogas from dairies to be a viable solution. These are big, complex efforts, and so there are going to be a lot of moving pieces to this. And I would mention that the Air District is already engaged in many of these efforts. For example, our work with the Marin Carbon Project, we're already trying to build markets for the carbon soil amendment. We're working with ARB and the CPUC on the oil and gas rulemaking. And of course, we're trying to improve, as I mentioned, the understanding of methane emissions. For black carbon, we're also engaged in many of these efforts. Wood smoke is obviously a very high priority for ARB. They specifically call out working with air districts to try to expand both in scope as well as geographically, some of the best wood smoke policies and programs. Staff is from the Air District is participating in the development of the sustainable freight strategy. And I wanted to say a few things again about forests. And you'll see in that bubble there's no percentage number there. And again, that's largely because what we're talking about is trying to stem this increase in wildfires and the emissions from wildfires. We do believe the Air District has a role to play here, and we're fleshing this out, but this is something that we'll see in our upcoming regional climate protection strategy, as well as many other efforts on a lot of these other programs. Now, with regard to reducing HFCs, this is probably an area where there is a particularly large potential for collaboration between the Air District and ARB, both in terms of, continuing to collaborate with ARB on enforcing existing rules, but also working with ARB and other agencies to develop additional rules and to expand enforcement of rules. So there most likely will be a good amount of collaboration here. So the strategy actually says local air districts have a key role to play, and indeed we do. So moving forward in helping ARB implement this strategy, we'll certainly be collaborating, as I mentioned, on rule development and enforcement, but there's also an important role for local governments in this effort. Several local governments in the Bay Area have included short-lived climate pollutant emissions in their greenhouse gas inventories, and have identified emission reduction strategies for these pollutants. What we want to do, staff at the Air District, is try to help create good methodologies and standardized ways for local governments to all be including these kinds of emissions in their inventories and their climate action plans and sharing best practices. There's also going to be a good amount of content and a robust control strategy in the Clean Air Plan and the Regional Climate Protection Strategy for short-lived climate pollutants, and we're collaborating with ARB staff on developing that. We convened an expert group about a year ago that included ARB staff to develop some concepts for our Regional Climate Protection Strategy, and the timing of these two documents is excellent, so I think that we'll see that, again, they're very complementary and supportive. And then finally, this whole emissions category is really kind of having us look at new emission sources and potential new partnerships. An example of this is looking at the soil carbon sequestration and the work that we're doing with the Marin Carbon Project. It's a very new kind of approach for us and a new type of partnership, but these are the kinds of things that we see we will be able to avail ourselves to as we pursue short-lived climate pollutants. So we're looking forward to continuing to work with ARB on this, and especially in the implementation. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Abby. Do you have any comments or questions? Katie, go ahead.
Thanks so much. Great presentation. Two questions. One, I know working in Marin County on the Marin Carbon Project, that's been great, and the Air District partnering on that. There's, as we know, a ton of potential there. And in Marin County, and I believe in Sonoma County as well, actually for now probably at least a generation, they've been practicing, our farmers and ranchers have been practicing a lot of, without knowing it, they were doing carbon sequestration. We've actually been spreading manure and doing all those practices. So there's really good, that's got a good foundation, and we know that can be taken farther. But I was, one of the things we're running into in Marin County is in our efforts and our partners in waste management's efforts to get people to redirect their food waste into the compost. We're running into, we've hit sort of the ceiling, if that's, the education is really tough. Getting people to change their behavior patterns and put their food waste into the compost bin, we're running up against a wall. I was talking to Joe Garbarino about this a couple weeks ago, and I think and given that a lot of our waste management are in the private sector, I think there's a role for someone to play in towards giving, helping provide funding towards education, towards changing those behavior patterns. And when you look at that graph, that 51% of the methane emissions by source are around recycling and waste. I mean, it's there's a lot of opportunity there. So I guess I'm using that as an example of, is there funding available at the state level, at the regional level, to help the education efforts that are necessary to get to make progress on some of these opportunities that require cooperation on the part of us as residents? So I don't know if that's cap and trade money. I don't know what it is, but it's about, I mean, you need funding to get some of this done.
Right. Well, I know that ARB staff are listening to this webcast right now, so that's a very good point to be made as they're receiving comments on this strategy. I don't think there's cap and trade money currently for education and outreach activities like this, but we are developing our regional climate protection strategy, and one thing that the consumption-based inventory has indicated to us is that food waste, the wasting of food, is a very significant issue. And so we're looking at ways to try to limit the wasting of food, whether that's from large, you know, food, you know, grocery stores.
It's all the way around.
It's the whole cycle. Yes.
And I would just say that on all these around the methane, if ARB is listening, I mean, our dairies, the waste public wastewater treatment plants, they're in order to go to the next level and do bring in the technology or best practice. It takes money, it takes funding, and we don't have it locally. Even the private sector or public sector. So we need funding coming from somewhere to move the dial in a lot of these areas.
Thank you, Abby. I think that's an excellent presentation, and look forward to hearing next steps on that. Okay, I don't have any public comments for this. Is that right? So that brings us to any other comments or questions by committee members? Mr. Haggerty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd hoped to do this at the board meeting yesterday, but I wasn't able to. But I did want to publicly thank, I think it's Luz Gomez. Okay, and also Wayne Kino, I have a problem in my district with dust, and we had a public hearing the other day in which there was probably about 150 people there, and Luz was there, and also Wayne was there as a speaker and a problem solver, and so I just wanted to publicly thank them. I hope that you can pass that on.
And will do. Then, will do.
Okay, thank you. And then about a month ago, we closed a highway in Alameda County, Highway 84, which runs between probably the Tri-Valley and the Tri-Cities, which is Livermore, Pleasanton, and Dublin, and also Fremont, Newark, and Union City. So there's a seven-mile highway in between that is kind of rich in history, but Supervisor Valle and myself are engaged in a project to create a trail through it, we shut it down. We had about Fremont Police estimates 15,000 people. I think they were a little high. I think we were probably somewhere around 10,000 people. But needless to say, it was hugely successful. People were able to walk the highway, enjoy it. We had people out there with easels painting, and we had the historic train running, and there was bicyclists and bicycle clubs out there. It was a huge success, and I know that Lisa Fasano, somebody from her organization, was out there representing us as the AIR district, and it was great to see somebody there. So I just wanted to, again, publicly thank Lisa's group for being there. And whoever that young lady was, she was very pleasant.
Staff? You want to? Okay. We're done. So our next meeting will be on January 21st at 9:30. We're adjourned. Thank you very much.